So tonight's central topic is ethics, action, and the power that action can have on changing our minds. As we saw, that we struggle to change the conditions you've just been describing, Peter, how life throws things at us. How do we bat with those things that life throws at us? How do we act in response? And obviously action is only part of the response. Obviously there's a mental component, but often that precedes the action. So we'll be looking at a fairly broad definition of action, really. We're going to include thinking and intentions, setting up intentions. That in itself, they're kind of proto-actions, because from those actions follow. So we're going to look at that a bit tonight. So actions as a tool in the toolbox for changing our minds. The Buddha said that actions actually shape us. What we are is a result of our previous actions, to some extent. He says, I am born of my actions. I am the owner of my actions. I am heir of my actions. The key phrase there for me is, I am born of my actions. So actions have a huge part to play in shaping who we are. In fact, neuroscience backs up the idea that actions are very powerful. Every action creates, has affects our brains. Neural pathways are established. And this is a perfectly natural part of our adaptive learning process. If you like, neural pathways are lines of communication set up. And if we say we do something, and there's an immediately unpleasant feedback, well, that's one sort of neural pathway, one sort of line of communication established. We avoid that particular behaviour in future. So that's aversive learning. But if it's not, if we do something and then there's no immediate sort of a negative feedback, it's like we have walked through a field of grain of wheat. You look back and you see, it's very clear the way I've come, and it's going to be easier tomorrow when I need to go through the field again. I can follow the same path. So it's like an action makes it easier to repeat that action. Or in the case of aversive learning, I'm not going to go down that particular line again. So it's actions and the results of those actions predispose us to future actions. And the more we repeat an action, the deeper it's like a trough, like water going down a hillside. Where is a trough? And then the trough just gets deeper and deeper. Well, if we repeat actions, that neural messenger, our pathway, just gets deeper and easier until it forms a habit. So it's almost effortless. We just do it, like driving a car. We just get in and our limbs just go to where they need to go. And it's so we don't even have to think about it. Another metaphor that's used is that actions are like seeds. You sow an action, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a character. You sow a character, you reap a destiny. And that's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. So every action, this is quite sobering, I think. Every action, no matter how small, has an effect on us. Is every action potentially is significant? The Buddha says, do not underestimate good. He means good actions. Thinking, it will not affect me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise person, little by little, fills themselves with good. So it's like with small actions, we create our habits, we create our character. According to Emerson, we create our destiny. Of course, we are creatures of habit, aren't we? It would have been interesting if we'd gone into the same room and if everyone had sat into the same seats. That often is the case. That's often what happens because it's kind of, there's less energy expended when you just follow a habit. It's we've only a limited amount of mental energy. So habits are useful insofar as they save on mental energy. Certainly with the car analogy, you know, it's, you don't, as I say, it's effortless. You get in and you are playing a musical instrument. Your fingers know where to go on the guitar, for example. Or just going, if you have a route to work or a regular place for the gym, you don't have to think about it. You just, your body goes there without any thought. But this habit, this nature, this habitual nature that we have is also problematic, potentially, because habits can be harmful. So if we have habits around eating unhealthily, or drinking excessively, or maybe telling untruths, there's so many different types of habits that we can develop that we know are not helpful for us. And then they're difficult to shift. Habits require a certain amount of energy, I'm kind of stating the obvious, to kick, because there's a short-term ease or gain. So to put the energy in to change them, it's like a short-term effort to shift it. And addictions are the prototypical kind of habits that are give pleasure in the short term but pain in the longer term, and it requires effort in the short term to really shift a habit. So I want to just look at habits around, well, from a point of view of, so a response, something happens to us, and often our response is habitual. And Buddhism focuses in on the moment that we have a stimulus and we respond, and how we can affect our response. It's like a crucial moment within Buddhist thinking, Buddhist psychology. It's called a gap. And it is how we can work with habits. It's the Buddhist message as to how we can work with habits, how we can shift our habits. So here we are with our habits. You're landed with this package, really, of views and assumptions and habits and views and aspects of your experience. It's almost like all of those views and mental habits affect your experience of the world. So if you're an aggressive person, you'll find the world is an aggressive place. If you're a very gentle person, the chances are people will be gentle to you, so the world is a more gentle place. So there we are with all these accumulated habits. And then something happens. Maybe we see some cakes in a shop window, and we have a certain hedonic response, a feeling tone, or a hedonic tone. Let's call it feeling tone, and I'll use that phrase in future. So that's either pleasure or displeasure, pleasure or pain, pleasant or unpleasant. So it could be an unpleasant feeling. So you get an email about a really challenging meeting that's going to come up with your boss. So that maybe is an unpleasant feeling arises from that particular stimulus. And you have a reaction. And the first part of the reaction is internal. It's you push away potentially the unpleasant. So that meeting that's coming up, you kind of just put it at the back of your mind. Are you your response is anxiety, stress, or it could be, if it's the cake example, it could be you really begin to think, oh yeah, I could just do with a nice big cream cake. So that's craving and aversion and desire, and then that'll lead to an action. So an external reaction. So it could be a habitual disregarding. I don't know. Maybe you're into box sets. So the evening that you get that email about the difficult meeting that's coming up, maybe you just binge on box sets, the latest distraction, something just to take your mind off it. Or in the case of the cake, it could be your external reaction is straight into the shop and buy half a dozen cream cakes. And then that simple following of your habitual response to the feeling, the pleasant or unpleasant feeling, and the subsequent aversion or desire, just consolidates. It just reinforces the sort of person you are. So I'm the sort of person who, when he sees a cream cake, goes in and buys it. Or I'm the sort of person, when he hears about an uncomfortable meeting, he kind of distracts himself from it. So it's like a self-reinforcing habit. So I don't change. I just my habits get reinforced. So it's a vicious circle where habits just get deeper and more entrenched. Another possibility, there's this self with its views and tendencies and attitudes and assumptions, experiences the stimulus. Again, you have the feeling, pleasant or unpleasant. And the difference here is that we bring awareness into the gap between the feeling tone and the response. So this is the crucial moment. This is the moment that Buddhism really focuses on. All of it so far is fairly spontaneous. We haven't much control over the stimulus. It's an external stimulus. And then the pleasantness or unpleasantness, again, we haven't much control over that. But we have control. The gap is where we do begin to have some level of control over what's going on in our minds between the feeling tone and the response. So if we can bring awareness into this gap, if we can, rather than rushing ahead into the reaction, if we can kind of count to 10 sort of thing, there are various ways, various practical approaches you can apply. You can attend to the body. What's going on in my body? Where do I feel this pleasure? I see the cream cakes. Where do I actually feel that somewhere in my body? This, is it maybe in the throat or in the chest or in the stomach? Or you know, when I get that email, is there a sinking feeling in the very base of my stomach of discomfort? And by attending to that, I'm kind of creating a bit of spaciousness around that pleasure or displeasure. And that means that I just don't go hurtling into a response. So there's an urge with the pleasure or the displeasure, the pleasure or the pain. There's an urge to do something like push away or grasp. And what we're doing is we're holding back on the verge of that urge, if you like. And we're bringing awareness, we're flooding the situation with awareness so that we can respond more consciously. We're holding back on the response, and then we respond according to our values, according to the way we choose to respond. And this is the crucial aspect of this point, is we're bringing choice rather into the situation rather than simply doing the knee-jerk, automatic reaction. So it's a creative juncture allowed by bringing awareness into the gap. And if we are creative in our response in terms of noticing, you know, not simply going for the craving or the aversion, well, then our external response, the action that follows on, can be creative as well. So rather than reacting, we're responding. So we can cultivate patience in the case of the fear around the meeting with the boss, or in the case of the cream cakes in the window, we might look the other way and think, look, I've already had two cream cakes today, I don't need another one. And then that has an effect on who we are. Again, it changes the neural networks, the neural pathways rather, within our own brains. So we become the sort of person who can hold back, bring awareness to the gap, and respond creatively. We become a more free person. So we are changing. So this is a virtuous circle. It becomes easier then to bring, to repeat that circle. So it's obviously an idealized version, but I think it's useful to highlight the principle. So a question then. Record. So one of the key ways we determine whether an action and therefore a habit that results from that action potentially is useful or not is the effect it has on us. So if we are polite to people, we find people are polite back to us. If we're aggressive to people are aggressive back. So we learn from our experience. Mm. So that's obviously one of the main ways. And it says this is stating the obvious, as I say. Another possibility for finding out what is ethically good or bad, using those terms, is a certain innate conscience, if you like, an intuition. And I think most of us have some level of intuition around ethics, and different traditions, spiritual traditions, have formulated a very similar principle: do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, for example. As it's just one example. Or in the pagan tradition, I think it's love and do what thou wilt. Sort of the golden rule.
Just one thing. When you're talking ethics, are you talking values? Is it synonymous with values? Because the way you're talking now, to me,
yes,
is values.
Yes. Yes, that's the terrain we're getting into now. Very much so, values. So really, the whole topic of ethics is based on a sense that there are values that one can recognize and uphold and lead a life on the basis of that it's possible to lead a life on the basis of those values. So values are fundamental to ethics. So in some traditions, that's the language used is good and bad, right and wrong, to express values. We're not going to use that language. Buddhism doesn't use that language, at least my sense of it. But how are we going to differentiate between what is good and just still using that language, what is good and what's bad, what's useful and what's wholesome and what's unwholesome, that are helpful and unhelpful? Well, the Buddha does provide some indicators. Certainly the intuitive approach, the approach of depending on our experience, well, that can be painful. Having to learn from our own mistakes, that's can be painful. Following the intuitive approach of just our instinctive conscience, well, some people have more finely tuned sense of conscience than other people, a more finely tuned sense of values or ethics. But the Buddha comes up with a set of guidelines for what is helpful, unhelpful. And they're called the precepts. And there are five. There are various sets, actually, of them. And one set is five precepts. Let's skip that. And these are the five precepts in their negative form. I undertake to abstain from taking life, taking the not given. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct, false speech, and taking intoxicants. So these are the five fundamental precepts And you could call them values, I think. It depends how you define value. Maybe these are more tips that help you to live out certain values. But I think before the night is out, I think it'll be possible to draw out perhaps the fundamental value behind all of these precepts. Now, we're not so used to the word precept in ethics. Certainly in a Christian culture or a post-Christian culture, perhaps what's more familiar is the term commandment. And that's what these are not. So these are more to be taken in the spirit of friendly tips. So it's like going to the gym and maybe you have an instructor, and the instructor says, well, you need to eat a bit like, a diet with a balanced set of proteins, carbohydrates, etc. You need to do so many reps on this machine and that machine. You need to exercise one day, have a rest day, and exercise the next day. You'll get a whole set of tips as to what you need to do to achieve your particular goal. Whether it's to lose weight or gain weight, you'll have had that discussion with them. And they'll advise you because they're in the know. They've done the training, they've got the certificate, and you follow them. You follow their advice. So in a sense, that's what the Buddha is doing in giving us these. These are tips, these are advice, training, precepts for living a happier life, for making a contribution to the world, to make the world a better place. That's one way of putting it, from somebody who knows. So the Buddha has had his experience of enlightenment, which I've described as seeing the way things really are. And it's only really on that basis that the Buddha can then go ahead and propose these precepts for action, for evaluating our behaviour, for evaluating whether it's going to be, in inverted commas, good, bad, useful, unuseful, wholesome, unwholesome.
Skillful.
So I'm going to come to the word, the phrases that are used, the descriptors in Buddhism are skillful, unskillful. So I'll come to that and why Buddhism uses those terms in preference to good and bad.
Can I ask?
Yes, please.
Assisted dying?
Okay, well, let's come to that. So we're going to go through these five precepts.
Oh, you've been through these. Okay.
And we'll see where they fit in. That's great to have a big question like that. And how does it fit in this scheme? And not just how does it fit in, but, you know, what's the approach? What's the approach to looking at assisted dying? How does it stack up in the context of the precept? So maybe just to go into a little bit more detail about this idea. We're a little bit short on time. So the precepts, Buddhism would argue that these precepts come from the Buddha's experience of the way things really are, and we formulated that in terms of dependent origination. So in a sense, these precepts flow from that fundamental law, dependent origination. If it applied to ethics, dependent origination can be translated as actions have consequences. Every act we perform is a condition, and conditions follow from conditions. Conditions prevent things happening, conditions cause things to happen. So, you know, just us being here tonight, I think I mentioned this example last week, is on the basis of a whole set of conditions, causal conditions. So it's kind of an abstract or impersonal, not abstract, impersonal law, this dependent origination. And when, as I say, applied to ethics, as actions have consequences. So we are connected with so many other beings, and our actions affect those beings with whom we are connected. Dependent origination actually implies an intimate interconnection between all beings. So it is quite a... that the implications of dependent origination are far-reaching. So this is an impersonal law, dependent origination. It's like the law of gravity, in a sense. It's not theistic. It doesn't require a god, a creator, a judge. So Buddhist ethics doesn't have a judge. This is the key difference between Buddhist ethics, say, and Christian ethics. The authority is our own conscience. So Buddhist ethics does not, it's not about obedience. So that's why they're not commandments. There are tips which, if we follow, we will live happier lives. So again, the emphasis is on rather than good, bad, because good, bad, certainly in my mind, can kind of lead to judgmentalism, such that I will beat myself up for the bad things I do. Or I'll beat, once I've got a clear idea of right and wrong and good and bad, I'll beat someone else up with my moralism, you know, the finger wagging. So it's either a stick to beat ourselves, with which to beat ourselves up, or to beat someone else up. It's this right and wrong and good and bad language. So the language of skillful, unskillful is useful, certainly in my mind, because a skill can be acquired by practice. So that's what... the emphasis with these precepts is to practice them and grow, develop one's skill in them. Each one of them provides a direction. Now, I didn't give the positive side of each of the five precepts, which is important. So we looked at what you want to avoid, what you commit to avoiding. Now we look at what we commit to doing more positively. Cultivating loving kindness, generosity, stillness, simplicity and contentment, truthful speech and mindfulness. And these are the direct opposite of the previous. So rather than abstaining from harm, we commit to loving kindness. Rather than abstaining from stealing, we commit to generosity. Rather than abstaining from sexual misconduct, we commit to stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Rather than abstaining from, well, it's as well as rather than. It's just the rather than, I mean, as an emphasis. So rather than emphasizing not telling lies, how was it phrased? False speech. Rather than emphasising false speech, we're emphasising what we do practice, or try at least, and that's truthful speech. And rather than avoiding taking intoxicants, we cultivate mindfulness, awareness. So we'll go through each of these five, Roger and myself, as a way to draw out Buddhist ethics and hopefully illustrate Buddhist ethics. Because I think it's when you chunk it down to the nuts and bolts that you begin to get an impression of what Buddhist, how it works. Fundamentally, Buddhist ethics is about taking responsibility. So events can trigger you, particularly on the basis of your conditioning. But how you respond to those events is your responsibility. And this is quite an empowering statement, really, this attitude. We can take control of our lives through developing awareness, the awareness of our intentions, of our actions, and what our values are, and how those actions stack up against our values. And by cultivating this awareness, we can develop a more conscious life and bring more choice into our life. But it there's a demand there. I mean, in a sense, it's scary. If every action of ours has an effect and affects the people that we're connected to, that's a responsibility. That's quite scary. But it's also empowering because it means every act can change us, can change the people around us, can change the world. So it's both a bit scary and empowering, encouraging. Fundamentally, I'd say the ultimate value here behind all these precepts, both the negative and the positive forms of them, is love. So the first of the precepts, loving kindness, you could say is the king of the lot because it's the ring that rules them all. You could say all the other precepts are expressions of the first precept of loving kindness. So generosity, you could say, is an expression of loving kindness. Abstaining from sexual misconduct, that's loving kindness, you could say. Our stillness, simplicity and contentment, that's loving kindness towards yourself. And we'll go into what stillness, simplicity and contentment really look like. That'll illustrate that point. False speech is aggression, is in a sense is harming other people. Truthful speech, we do ourselves a favour and other people. Similarly with mindfulness. So you can see that in a sense the key value here, I would say, is love behind all of Buddhist ethics. All the other precepts follow are expansions, applications of love, or in the negative form, non-harm. Okay, let me just take a look at the time. Oops, yes. So moving on to the second precept, which is, I undertake to abstain from taking the not given, stealing, you might paraphrase that. Or with open-handed generosity, I purify my body. Well, maybe at some point I'll talk about the I purify my body, but let's not get sidetracked. Let me talk about...
Can I just say, just as an observation?
Yes.
Forgive me if I'm talking too much, but I was looking at the generic, are you a taker or you're a giver? I was not looking at stealing or not stealing. And I just wonder whether it's more helpful to talk about loving kindness is usually associated with people being a giver and they're not takers. And believe me, you can classify so many people as takers in this world. So just as an observation, I didn't associate it with stealing or not stealing. I was looking at it very much as what kind of person your intentions point.
I would go along with that. And in fact, we could, in a sense, we could leave the second precept at that. There is giving and there's taking. There is stealing, but a lot of our taking is on a much lower level, a bit more subtle. We might arrive late for a meeting. That means we deprive the other people of their time. We might steal the limelight in a little group, preventing other people from getting a word in. It can be very subtle, or it can be more on the legal end, like copyright. We might get a pirated DVD. That's all taking the not given. The person who produced the original, who has the copyright, didn't sanction the copying of the DVD. So there are much more subtle ways than just stealing. But ultimately, they're all expressions of greed, of the taking rather than the giving. Putting my wants above something, and this is really what you're emphasising, Roger, putting my wants above someone else's suffering. My wants and needs are more important than this other person's suffering.
Building up, maintaining your ego, which is very fragile.
But if you take ego out of it,
well, interesting.
Then you have. You're going to go. I would argue you would go much more in this direction, much easier. If you didn't see it about a win-loss situation, you just saw it as in terms of actually what are the honest truths.
Well, may I say that some traditions they talk about, you know, working on the ego, becoming egoless.
Yeah, well, I think Freud has got a lot to answer for, to be honest.
So Buddhism has a lot to say about the self.
Yeah.
Mm. It tends not to use the word ego, certainly our tradition doesn't so much, because ego comes with quite a baggage with Freud and Jung. Not that, you know, some are very helpful, but not, it's not the same. The sense of self in Buddhism doesn't they don't map onto each other that well. In some ways they do. But certainly what giving does in terms of the self is it expands the sense of self. So Buddhism doesn't say there's no self, but Buddhism would say that the sense of self is not the limited, contracted self that only looks after its own needs. It's the expanded sense of self in which I and you are connected in many ways, in many more ways than we can think of. We share so much, more. It's in common than separates us. So we're intimately connected. We share so much more than we can think of. And therefore, in a sense, myself, I'm not separate from you. We're not these separate, independent, fixed beings. So that's the sort of self that Buddhism denies. Buddhism has a sense of a fluid and open and expansive sense of self. And it's that sense of self is honoured, that sense of connection with other people is honoured when we give. So this is the opposite of the stealing. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body, I give. I serve. The Buddha just emphasize so much the spiritual benefits of giving. Monks, if people knew, as I know, the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat without sharing. Even if it were their last morsel, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared it. And there's a whole list of other benefits that we could go through. But we're just a bit short of time. I'll just see if there's any crucial points I'd like to make. What can we give? We can give, obviously, material goods. We can give our time and energy. We can give a smile. Knowledge, education is seen in Buddhism as one of the greatest things we can give, because with knowledge and education, people can reach their potential. Encouragement, just encouraging people to reach their own potential, our fearlessness, giving people confidence. Okay, let's move on to the third precept. Is that me as well? I'm on three. Okay, great. So the third precept is to abstain from sexual misconduct, or in the positive form, with stillness, simplicity, and contentment, I purify my body. So the emphasis here is sexual misconduct. Actually, that's only because sexuality is one of our strongest drives. But actually, it's really more about our drives, and it's really more about unbridled or neurotic desire. How do we relate to neurotic desire? Sexuality is only one form. There's also eating. That's another form of potentially very strong desire. But my sense is that sexuality can trump food. Sorry, bear with me just while I find. Yeah, maybe acquisitiveness is a strong a drive for us. You know, that the latest iPhone or the faster car, may for some people maybe just being fashionable is the urge that is or, you know, obviously for some people it's drugs, it's or for other people it's drink. But this precept singles out sexuality as the one of the most powerful drives, one of the most powerful forms of craving. So I suppose really that's the word, that's the key word for this precept, it's craving. Now, Buddhism does not say that craving, that desire is unskillful. Craving is more neurotic desire. Desire in itself is healthy, according to Buddhism. Desire is simply a manifestation of energy. It's what we need. If we're going to achieve anything, we need to have desire behind it. Desire is motivation, essential to any worthy project, really. Otherwise, we stagnate if we don't have motivation. So Buddhism would say, yes, desire is potentially a resource. It's a source of energy, but it just needs channeling in the right direction. It's neurotic desire is craving. And that is desire for something that cannot satisfy the need we're trying to satisfy. So say we're bored and we eat because we're bored. We're not actually really addressing the boredom. Why are we bored? Or we're lonely and we drink in order to just drown out or numb the loneliness. Or we're grieving. So we whatever we do to try and distract ourselves from what is actually going on. And so we're not really addressing the issue that's at the root. So we're using some sort of pleasure principle, if you like, to drown what's going on. And this just leads to suffering. This is craving. And as the second noble truth says, the cause of suffering is craving. Craving and aversion. Aversion, if you like, being the flip side of craving. And of course, it has societal consequences. Craving drives the consumer society, drives a very wasteful society and a society that is damaging its own environment, which at the end of the day is causing and will cause huge suffering. Now, sure, it could be that we need a break. We've had a tough day and a bit of, a bottle won't do us any harm. It's actually, none of these are absolutes. You know, we can be kind to ourselves. And maybe having a jar is simply that, being kind to ourselves. There are no absolute kind of bans on. So alcohol I'll get on to alcohol. That's the fifth precept of doing a jar. Let's stay with sex. Let's focus on sexuality. So sexual misconduct, which is being referred to specifically here in the third precept, is an expression of craving and attachment. And Buddhism is not judgmental about sexuality, as long as the sex is consensual. So it's got no problem with same gender sex, no problem with homosexuality. It's no problem with sex outside marriage, no problem with masturbation, so long as it's not harmful. and that the intention is not harmful. So that there are obviously certain actions which are harmful. Rape, abduction, non-consensual forms of sexuality are what is being described here in this precept. Of course, often relationships involve an additional person. So in the case of adultery, so there's a partner involved who is being harmed in the adultery. Or if we have a sexual relationship and we're not being honest in the, about, you know, what we want, we're not communicating what we want and what we don't want, and there's a misunderstanding about what's wanted or an unevenness, well, that can lead to harm. Or seeing others as sex objects and using them, exploiting them. These are combining craving and harm to other. So the craving harms ourselves, and potentially there are other people who are being disrespected, who are being harmed as well. So the opposite of, or the positive form of the precept, stillness, simplicity and contentment, it's very much about pausing activity. The stillness part of it, at least, is pausing our activity, that constant need to do, and facing ourselves, really being present to ourselves and aware of what's going on in our own minds and hearts. The simplicity, stillness, simplicity and contentment, giving time and space for one's own, the most important values that we ascribe to. So if we overwork, if we don't give ourselves enough time to stop, to be still, to be present to ourselves, to really see where we're at in terms of our values, whatever our values happen to be, then we're not being living a simple life in these terms, the terms that I'm defining here, simplicity. Simplicity is giving time and space to your highest values. Simplicity also involves fewer possessions, fewer material possessions, because possessions, certainly there's a price to pay. In my experience, there's a price to pay with possessions. They have their demand, and that can be perfectly fine. You know, again, Buddhism has not got a problem with possession, but if that is taking you away to the detriment of assessing your own values and your own behavior and your own life in terms of those values, then you're not living according to this simplicity as described by Buddhism. And finally, contentment. Seeking happiness in the your current state. So not always looking to the next field. Not always with that sense of the grass is greener. So really settling in, being content and accepting your situation as it is now. And this is not a passivity. It's accepting what is in the moment, what your experience is now. It's not saying, okay, this is acceptable in terms of, you know, whether it's just or unjust. It's just saying, this is where I'm at. I can accept my experience rather than denying what your experience is in the moment. You may decide on the basis of an acceptance of what your experience is, an acknowledgement of it, that what really needs to happen is something needs to change. But you can only go on to affecting the future on the basis of a thoroughgoing acceptance of the present, knowing where you're at in this moment, not living in denial. Okay, so that's the third precept. Over to you, Roger, for the fourth.
So the fourth precept is, I undertake the training principle of refraining from untruthfulness or false speech. I undertake to abstain from false speech. And the positive counterpart is, with truthful communication, I purify my speech. So we recognize that speech is really powerful. You know, we communicate with each other, and that's what we say has got a very significant impact on other people, to the good or to the ill, what we say. It's funny, isn't it? Words come out, you know, these words come out, and they take on a real power for themselves, and it can be really... It's funny, isn't it? The attention we need to put to what we say, you know, could be speech, which could be like careless. You know, you say something, oh, I didn't mean to do that, say that, but you say it. So you've got to be aware of what you say. I mean, at the extreme level, it's all about about lying, you know, being untruthful, you know, or being hateful. Hate speech, you can be very cruel. You can hurt someone through what you say. So the idea of sticks and stones will break my bones, but no words will ever hurt me, I don't believe that at all. I think what we say can be violent, because what you people take in, it can be very harmful, and. When you speak, when you can agitate, you know, when you hear people who rouse a crowd, could lead to violence, and you can instigate violence through what you say, through the messages you preach. You can be quite menacing. You can threaten through what you say. You can threaten violence, or, you know, to create fear or terror. You know, the worst example is like genocide. You know, the way that genocides were kind of condoned or encouraged was by putting, you know, society, something about in Rwanda, when people weren't viewed as people, they were viewed as insects, and so that, you know, you downgrade what, and then which kind of encourages people to be aggressive to people. So the message is very powerful. So if you lie, the consequences are that, you know, people won't trust you. You're not communicating. You know, you can create confusion. You can create fear. If you lie, you're not truthful. You lose friendships. You alienate people. It's interesting, isn't it, about the area around politics somewhere. You know, can you be a politician and be completely truthful and honest in what you say? It's quite skillful, isn't it?
It's
very, very difficult to be a political and be honest. It's such a... Can you? That's really very difficult. But, you know, a real, you know, a politician, you know, some people, you know, who are really true to what they say. You can think of examples of politicians who are truthful, and they, perhaps not so many, but you know, those who stand, they do stand out. You can use words to play games with people. You know, advertising is a way of using words and symbols in order to get across a message which may not always be accurate. Images on the screen, not accurate necessarily. It's not truthful. So advertising is a very tricky area around, isn't it? Trying to encourage people to buy or purchase something. But how can you be truthful in your communication in advertising? That's a real area of challenge, I think. So the opposite is truthful communication. So Bradley David talked about authenticity. So if you're truthful in what you communicate, you're being authentic. I suppose it's all about not withholding. So if you have something you need to say, you know, being truthful, you're being authentic because you're putting across something which you believe, rather than withholding something which needs to be said. So truthful communication, honesty creates friendships, it creates trust. It breaks down barriers. It promotes openness and sincerity between people. You get words of encouragement and support. Speech can be kind. Kindly speech is so much more positive than speech which is unkind. And you can communicate something which can be quite hard, but you communicate it in a kind of way, in a kindly way, getting a message across which can be quite painful, quite challenging. But if you do it in a kind of kind way, perhaps that can be really impactful. You know, the idea of kind of a positive criticism, when something needs to be said, you say it in a way which someone learns from, they don't feel undermined. So if we are honest in our communication, we can learn to be ourselves. You know, we can relate to people in an authentic, authentic and truthful manner, and it can be really a relief. You don't have to pretend to be someone you're not. It's quite a challenge, isn't it? When perhaps you're in fields where, you know, down the pub, you know, as men, but as blokes, and it's all about can you be really communicate with people rather than kind of like be superficial. For men in particular, for perhaps for anyone, it's about how you break and be a real, you know, really spend time with people, talk to people, and really communicate people rather than get into patterns of behaviour. It's all but, you know, routine, habitual, and actually not actually sharing anything at all. Brings people together, helps people. So it's important. You talk about the five precepts, and there's something called the 10 precepts, which reflects the importance of speech, because it breaks down, you know, full speech into a number of different areas, like harsh speech, frivolous speech, slanderous speech. So false speech. Frivolous speech is about things which are a bit meaningless, a bit gossipy, trivial, a bit pointless. You say things to kind of like fill the air for no particular reason. It's a bit of a waste of energy, can be. At worst, it can be unkind. You can, like comedies are a really tricky area, isn't it? Because people often use their comedy, base their comedy on hurting people. It's a bit of a cheap laugh, it's actually, but okay, is it really funny? But it's not really funny at all. It's a bit... the opposite of frivolous speech is meaningful speech. So what you try and ensure you say is when you communicate, because you communicate in a way which has got some meaning to it. You know, it's got a point to it. It saves energy, you know. And also, I suppose, if you say less is more, so there can be times when you don't need to speak, but you can communicate in a way through other ways, through the stillness, by sharing a meal together, you know, without, you know, sharing each other's company, without actually having to say anything. It's quite a relief, actually. I don't really have to speak, you know. We're having a really nice time together, but we're not actually having to say anything. That's really nice. I like the idea of like using your speech to like praise, you know, really speak joyfully about people. And so there's a lot in this tradition in Buddhism, about rejoicing in merit, about someone speaking positively about someone, speaking, you know, celebrating someone, which can be really, really create, really help someone. So speech can be communicated, you know, the importance of good eye contact, the importance of listening. So communicating is a way you can not communicate by not listening. So that's also a bit of the taking and not giving, isn't it? You know, you're not listening, you know, it's really disrespectful as well. So it's a really, so just emphasises the point of what we say, you know, we can be to the good and or to the harm. So it's so powerful, and you can build, you can, as you develop a skill in speech, it's an area of real opportunity to develop a something that can be really positive if you use that precept wisely.
Minutes, thanks very much, to look at the final fifth precept, which is abstaining from taking intoxicants, or in its positive form, with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. So, like with the third precept, which just focused initially on abstaining from sexual misconduct, there's a specific reference here to taking intoxicants. But actually, what is an intoxicant? It can be so much broader than just, say, alcohol or drugs. It might be gambling. It might be social media. You know, staying distracting yourself using Facebook. It might be box binging on box sets. Anything that really is about clouding your mind, taking it away from reality. And all of these are, you know, Buddhism would not say any of these are right or wrong. It's for us to decide our use of them. Is it skillful or unskillful? Is it helping us? Is it not helping us? And for example, with drink, I've no problem with having a pint of my favourite ale. The question is, you know, what is the effect of that on me in terms of this principle of clouding one's mind, of the possibility of being aware? Does it deprive me of awareness? Does it downgrade my awareness? But again, you know, maybe just giving myself a bit of a break is actually helpful and healthy. At what point does it stop being helpful and healthy? That's for us to decide. And to decide on the basis of where we're at. You know, if you were to decide, if you were a 5-pint drinker and you decide, okay, I'm just going to give up suddenly, you might find that the pressure that puts on you is not helpful. It might be more a question of actually slowly going in the direction of, you know, having what is, according to your own working out, what is a healthy level of intake. So again, there are no absolutes here. It's for us to decide what's skillful and the road to achieving that. So all the precepts are pointers. They give us a direction to go in. The positive side of the fifth precept is mindfulness, cultivating awareness, being present to our experience, whether it's the mental experience, the physical experience, the emotional experience, really being present to it. And as we were looking at with the gap, when we were talking about the gap, being aware of our response to our experience, rather than being on automatic pilot, rather than just having those knee-jerk responses unmindfully, where we're not in charge. So very much this precept is about conscious living. It's about really choosing our action and therefore being able to be responsible for them. And how we go about developing this quality of awareness is through largely attention, an intended attention. So really putting our intention into attending to our experience. In the mindfulness tradition, we were talking upstairs about it, one of the classic definitions of mindfulness is deliberate attention that is non-judgmental, attention to our experience, to our mental experience, our thoughts, our emotions, our physical experience, our movement, just how we move. So sometimes it's really useful to have a discipline like yoga or qigong or tai chi, which is a slow, deliberate set of movements that often combines breath, coordinates with the breath, to help us to develop this ability to really be present. I'll leave it there. And so the suggested home practice for next week is taking up a couple of the themes from today, tonight, and it's, can you choose a precept and consider the positive quality that it involves? So the positive form of the precept. And notice your actions this week that develop along the lines of the positive precept. And with all these ethical considerations, there's a basis. The basis of the consideration is loving kindness. So be kind to yourself in this, looking at your action in the light of the precepts. Be kind to yourself. Don't use them as sticks to beat yourself up, because that is the dark side of ethics, if you like, where you become judgmental and you beat yourself up with whatever the precept is. Because, you know, then it's self-contradictory. So that the basis of all the precepts is loving kindness. If you start to use these precepts as sticks with which to beat yourself up, to judge yourself, I'm no good at this, I'm not worthy, any of these kind of judgmental attitudes have no place within a Buddhist ethic and a use of the precepts. Okay, so that's the home practice for next week. There will be an email with the home practice in it. There will be a summary of tonight's material. There will be a list of the precepts. And
Are you going to share the... Because you said there are five, but some of them are also divided into others, correct?
The tenth precept.
That's a different set of precepts. It doesn't map completely on, but what Roger was saying is what it does, it gives four precepts on speech to emphasize the importance of speech. The ten precepts expands the five precepts. But it's not just that. It also takes out and leaves in. So it doesn't, for example, have that final precept of abstaining from intoxicants and developing mindfulness. It doesn't have that precept. So it's a kind of a different set of 10 precepts. But I think it's really a useful point Roger makes that actually authenticity is broader than just true or false.
Yeah.
You know, it's also those. The Sufis talk about the five gates, or four or five gates that you walk through, that you pass your language through, whatever you say. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it helpful? Is it harmonious? And only if it sort of satisfies all those gates, passes through all those gates, do you go ahead and say it. There's a kind of wisdom. That's just similar to what you were kind of referring to as subsections of a precept, but it kind of is. It is an elaboration of the authenticity or truthful speech precept. The monks can, I think, in the Theravadan tradition, we look at the different traditions in week six. Ordained monks in the Theravadan tradition have something like 256 precepts. So things get a bit more complex. Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention and engagement. Mm-hmm.